back to Classical Guitar Insider. This is your host, Brett Williams, and today on the show we have Siad Wells. Siad Wells is a guitarist, an arts administrator, and an activist based in Austin. She's currently getting her doctorate in Georgia, and we talk all about those things and more. It was an easy conversation to have. I'm real glad we got someone like her in arts administration to sort of rep us and as guitarists. It's a great thing. Makes me feel like the future might be bright after all. When you get someone who's, you know, that smart. Way smarter than I am. Siad Wells is on the show. Show is also sponsored by SavageClassical.com. That's S-A-V-A-G-E Classical.com. You go there, you tell him I sent you. All right, he's the only guy giving me any real money. RosettaPodcast.com/insider is giving me a little bit of money when you guys go there. Because you got to what? You got to get something out of it. You can't just give me some cash. I'm just kidding. RosettaPodcast.com/insider is $20 cheaper than it was on the last episode. That's $179.99 to learn the language of your choice or multiple languages at the same time. You got the little squares. You match the squares up with the word. You know, that kind of thing. Oh, there's an orange. There's a banana. Apfel, bananen. You can learn any language you want forever or not learn it. You got the software. You're bored. You want to buy something. You know, how many times have you been on Amazon in the last week? A lot. I would like you to take the money that you spend on Amazon and consider giving a little bit of it to me. All right? Just a little bit of money to me. It's not that hard. This is ridiculous. There are thousands of you listening to this show. Thousands. And I know you're spending money. I know you are, because I am. Let's make this an institution, right? We're having important conversations here that no one else is having. There are other podcasts. I do not listen to them. But I assume that they are mostly educational, right? Because that's what we're all about, is being educated. And that's great. Look, I've got my yoga app, you know. I like to think I'm at the point in my development as a guitarist where I don't, after all the money I spent in college, I probably, you know, shouldn't have to go to like a, you know, an online thing to learn how to play guitar. I feel confident. but I know that a lot of you, that's a huge sort of industry. That's great. These conversations, I'm pretty certain, are only happening here. I'm certain because there's so many listeners. So if you enjoy these kinds of conversations, please consider donating to the show. There's really no excuse. It's silly. It's real. If you've never donated to the show, it's kind of outlandish. This thing's been going for 9 years. All right, so let's get our act together. Let's donate to the show. That's all I'm going to say about it. That's not all I'm going to say about it. It's about time, right? Let's do it. Anyway, let's get on with the show. We have one of these important conversations we have happens right now. All right, so let's go ahead. Here's my conversation with Siad Wells.
So I'm a little bit further into that. So I was doing my coursework in Georgia, and then I got a job here in Austin, so I moved to Austin.
Right, you got a job with the Guitar Society, mm-hmm. right? And mm-hmm. what is that job?
Yeah, so I work as the director of individual giving at Austin Classical Guitar, and I'm the person who is supposed to ask you for money so that we can continue doing the great work.
Doing the very important work. And I feel, you know, I feel like listeners are probably going to be a little put off by the fact that I'm just Austin, Austin, Austin. Three out of our last five guests have lived in Austin at some
yeah,
point.
Yeah, I noticed that, yeah.
You're getting your, who are you studying with in Georgia?
Daniel Bolshoi.
Daniel Bolshoi. And so how do you like Austin so far?
Austin is great. It's neat. I wish that, you know, we weren't in a pandemic so that I could actually see Austin, because I've lived here since, you know, for like a year, and most of the time it's been pandemic time. But
because you go to these wonderful cities and it's a little bit of a bummer because you're like, wow, that would have been really cool to pop in there and have a beer or have a coffee over here, you know, stuff like that. Yeah. And Austin is all about that.
Right. I would say that Austin is probably one of the better places to travel to right now, because life for a lot of people is pretty normal. You know, everything is open. You can go and eat and drink and be merry as you wish, but I'm sure it's not like that in some places. And so it would be kind of a bummer to go to this place and, you know,
I would be remiss if I wasn't bringing up the fact that you're in Texas right now and Texas is going through some stuff. And how are you recovering from that? What was your experience with the storms?
Yeah, I kept power the entire time, so that was good, and lost water here and there, so that was a little bit.
I heard the power was costing people like thousands of dollars. Did you get hit with a huge bill?
No, I did not.
Oh, okay.
At least I haven't yet. So we'll see when my next bill comes around.
Anyway, go ahead. I interrupted you. Go ahead.
No, but I think we are fine now. It was a little bit of an inconvenience for me, but there are some people who, you know, it affected much more. So all things considered, doing well.
What's your experience with snow? Because, you know, you're in Austin, you're talking about Georgia. I mean, were you happy as a clam when it first happened?
Oh, yeah.
When it first started snowing?
So I'm from Tennessee.
Oh, okay.
And, you know.
They get a little bit of it.
Yeah, and I lived in Kentucky for a little bit, but that's still just a little bit more snow. So when it started snowing, I was like, snow, I love the snow. And then, you know.
And then it didn't stop.
No. And then it was, an ice sheet that was like 3-4 inches thick. And it was like, oh, snow, go away. Please go away.
I know. I was in Austin and there was, I feel like it snowed, but it probably didn't. But it was really cold for my first jury ever. And it was like snowy, icy, haily, cars slipping all over the place because there's no chains. People don't own chains in Texas, so they just slide all over the place. And I was so nervous and cold, and I just was just, what do I do? I think I went to like Einstein's Bagel. I don't know if that's still there.
It's still
Is
there.
Is it still
I
there?
Love, I love Einstein's, yeah.
Yeah. And I ate like a stale bagel back then. You know, the food wasn't as good as it is now. But What a miserable experience to be in Texas when it's too cold.
Yeah. There were lots of wrecks, and the road in front of my apartment complex was blocked off, so we couldn't leave, and we were just like stuck here. But you know, things are getting better.
Things are getting better. You know, so going down there, that's actually really interesting. How long were you into your doctorate when you're getting a doctorate in performance and guitar performance?
And guitar performance.
How long were you into your doctorate when you went to, you know, work for the society?
About 2.5 years.
Okay.
So I was in my third year, and I left in like the middle of the school year.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you said you're from Tennessee. So did you get started? Is that Nashville or what are we talking about?
I'm from Murfreesboro, which is really close to Nashville. It was like 30 minutes south of Nashville.
Were you able to study in Nashville when you were a kid with John Johns and stuff? Or
no, I didn't start playing guitar until I was like 14.
Mm-hmm.
And so I had a teacher at a music store. His name is Patrick Worley.
Always important to say those guys' names. Patrick Worley. I mean, huge shout outs because it's they don't get enough credit.
Yeah, and he's an awesome guy. And so I started taking lessons with him. And then I went to the University of Memphis. So I lived in Memphis for a little while. And did a music ed degree in choral music because there was no like music ed guitar education thing.
Right.
So they're like, well, we'll just stick you in choir, which was fine because I had been in choir for a long time before that. So, yeah, I did that degree. And then I went to Louisville, University of Louisville, and studied there. And then.
Who was at the University of Louisville?
Stephen Mattingly.
Yeah, I know Stephen Mattingly. Yeah. Yeah. Oh, that's huge. That's kind of a big program then. That must have.
Yeah.
That'll get you in the game. That'll get you settled.
It definitely.
You know, kind of coming from the sort of choral background, that's something that I think is really important. There's too many guitarists who can't sing or who haven't had the experience of singing. And, you know, it's such an integral part, I think, to being an interpreter or just, you know, being an expressive artist is sort of having I was talking to Matt Hensley, who you're working with now, and I remember when we were younger, he would sing Tedesco and play the part on the guitar, and I just was blown away by it. And I'm equally as blown away by the fact that all these other people just are like, I don't sing. You know, it's almost like the I don't compose thing. I don't do that. So, you know, were you able to sort of translate that artistically into what you were doing as a young guitarist?
think so, because I originally started out wanting to be like a singer-songwriter type of person.
Sure, yeah.
And so I was like, oh, you know, I can play guitar and I can accompany myself and I can write my own music and all of that. And then I was like, I guess I want to go to music school. And, you know, there's not a singer-songwriter degree at most music schools. And,
right.
And my parents were like, oh, we want you to do something where we feel like you can have a future. And so, you know, I did the music education thing because of that. But I think it was a really, in hindsight, like, it was a really great decision on my part. And I'm glad I did it, because in choir, you get this opportunity to be with people.
Yeah.
And you get the opportunity to collaborate and to work in small groups and in large groups. And you get to do a lot of different kinds of music, and you get to learn languages for singing and all of that. So that's really cool. And then as a guitarist, you know, we don't get that experience. And this might be controversial, but guitar orchestra isn't as gratifying an ensemble experience as choir is.
Yeah.
I think for the reasons I just mentioned. And so, yeah, being a singer, I think, helped me a lot. And it still, like, informs a lot of the way that I will phrase things or play things.
That's really interesting. That's a good point about sort of the guitar orchestras, which are becoming more and more, you know, visible. You sort of see it in a lot of the communities. And it's sort of, it's a great thing, as we all know, because it allows people to get together, to share ideas, and to play together, because we don't get an opportunity to play together. But obviously, a choir, almost every member of a choir is coming from the experience of being in another choir, you know? So it's the experience and sort of the ease with which they communicate ideas and have systems. Whereas we're kind of like, okay, well, what do you guys want to play? Does anybody want to arrange something for us? You know?
Yeah. I think like the guitar ensemble orchestra is a great educational tool.
Yeah.
Like, I think it does so much for especially students in middle school and in high school. When you get to the college level, sure. But I think, you know, for younger students, it really is important. But the choir thing, and I also believe that everyone can sing.
Me too. Well, I don't know if I believe that, but sell it to me.
That doesn't mean we all sing well, mm-hmm. but I think that we all have the ability to be in an ensemble and to sing and to share in this like really expressive music making. And you get that from choir. And with guitar ensemble, I think a lot of it too is like I just never feel like the music is good, because like you mentioned, there's always this, well, who's going to arrange something, or we're just going to use an arrangement that already exists, and the arrangements are never what guitarists want to play either.
Right. And the players are kind of the model right now is sort of a pay to play model, which means that you're going to have people of various skill levels coming in, which is a good thing again for the community. I've never seen it perform. I don't know, but I don't go to the New York one. I don't spend enough time, you know, with John and the New York Guitar Society. I need to change that. Like, I need to take responsibility for that and become a more active member of my community up here, and see that guitar ensemble. But from my experience, I've never seen them. So I want to say that because I love those people, but, I've never seen one that I've been like, wow, you know, that was amazing. You know, with a good, maybe those kids from Asia. I've seen like kids from Asia do amazing things, like little children do things, and they stop and they all pose at the same time and stuff like that. That's interesting.
Yeah. I think that's a thing too.
Choreographed.
Like, there isn't the ability to continue being in a guitar ensemble professionally beyond, you know, when you're a graduate student, maybe.
Well, so that's
So I think there's just like, there's no road for that.
Where do you think the work is going to be? Because you're getting your doctorate now. You've already started working for, a relatively lucrative organization that maybe can support, you know, support people to a certain degree. But where do you think this doctorate is sort of taking you?
That's a great question. And that's because I keep asking myself that almost every day. especially as I get closer and closer to, you know, hopefully finishing. But I don't know, you know, I went into this thinking that I was going to be the, you know, a guitar professor, and not that I won't be.
Right.
But I did a little bit of teaching, of course, and that was great and that was fine. But I didn't feel like I was going to be able to support myself long term working, you know, at six different places. And there was one where I was driving an hour and a half one way to get to, and that was not going to be sustainable in the long run. And so I was like, I need to find something else. And I had always enjoyed, you know, arts admin and being a person who organizes things and wants to build community and opportunities for people. And so that's where my love or my interest in the nonprofit sector came in. So I think that a lot of people will end up with jobs. And I think that's a good thing.
What kind of, you think, you're saying you think guitarists will end up with jobs post-grad?
Yeah, I think so. Jobs, sometimes teaching, but sometimes not. And, you know, I do a little bit of teaching for ACG, but that's not my primary role. And the thing I do enjoy about my role is that I have a job. It's sustainable. It supports me and my life and all the things that I need. And I'm also still able to play and do concerts and those types of things. And it's not a bad, it's a pretty good setup in my opinion. So I think a lot of guitarists will end up with jobs that are not teaching, and they will maybe see the light because I think it's a good thing that people have other interests and have other experiences, because it teaches me a lot about music as well.
Yeah.
To not be only doing, you know, performing or teaching.
You know, if they make it and they have a place on the stage, they generally only do that, and they don't have all these other experiences that the rest of us have, you know, whether it's, you know, whether it's having to drive an hour and a half. I don't know. That does something to me. I'm glad that I had those experiences.
Yeah.
I'm not glad that I still have them, but I'm glad that I had them.
Right. I think it gave me such a perspective that I didn't have before I continued going down the doctorate path. Because in music school, you're kind of sold, I don't want to say a dream, but you're sold a dream that you will be a performer. And that is the only thing that you will do.
Yeah.
And if, and only if you enjoy teaching, then you can also do that. But there are not a lot of those jobs. So what do you do? And I was like, I need to find something else to do. Like, and I think it's good to enjoy other things. Like, I have other interests outside of music.
Right.
And that's good. And we should really be encouraging, I think, people who are coming up, who are in school, to do that. And I think we were also sold a dream that you can't do that. You can't be a person who performs but is an engineer or something, you know, like any number of things. But yeah, the dream is not what it's cracked up to be.
Right. I think that's something that we all, you know, more or less kind of figure out. But, you know, as far as you were talking about your, you know, relationship with arts, you know, organization, and that you had, it sounded like you came into this with some previous you know, experience. What was that experience? Was it in Georgia or Tennessee, or when did you start kind of, you know, picking up that sort of gauntlet of work?
Yeah, I would say kind of when I was like an undergrad student, not so much the arts like in the community in Memphis, because I think when you're an undergrad, it's really difficult to be involved in your community, your community, like outside of campus. But I was involved in like running clubs and like student organizations. So we had like a student guitar society, and there was like a choir thing. And then there was NAFME, which is the Music Educators Society. And so I was always kind of like really, really involved in those student organizations. And then I got to Louisville and I had a little bit more, you know, time and freedom to be like really involved. And there is a guitar society in Louisville. And so I became like just really involved. I dove into that. I helped do any number of things. I started the guitar orchestra that they have there. And so, yeah, I think it was then that I started to to be able
to. Wow, you started the guitar orchestra. That's.
Yeah, yeah. So it was pretty cool. It was a community. It was like a.
But I thought you hated guitar orchestras. I'm just joking. We love guitar orchestras.
Yeah, we do. Yeah. It was a cool group too, because it was mixed age. Yeah. So it was like intergenerational. So there were some adults and then there were some young kids, and it was cool. Like it was chill. It was fun. But I think it was in Louisville that I really started to see and notice that, oh, there's a career in arts admin that can be, you know, really fulfilling as an artist and as an administrator, but that can also allow me to continue to explore my work as a performer and a teacher. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, coming out of that degree, I was like, what am I going to do? Because, you know, I had no idea. And so I had applied to a few master's programs for arts admin and then to a few doctorate programs, and then the doctorate programs just were a better deal. And so I was like, okay, I'm going to pursue that. But about 2 years ago, I heard about this program called Sphinx Lead, which is a program for, it's a 2-year arts administrators professional development program for arts administrators of color that is run by the Sphinx organization. And so I, on a whim as a guitarist, I was like, they don't really do guitar, but I'm going to apply anyway.
Yeah.
And so I ended up getting into that program, and it was like a fast track to learning what is arts admin.
Yeah.
And seeing that that's a really cool career path. And so I was like, okay, I'm going to do this. And so I just learned so much there. And that's kind of how I got like really, really involved in this.
That's so cool, because now we have a guitar advocate over there.
Yeah.
That's gonna, you know, I mean, you know, cause it is, I mean, you know, this we do, and you kind of felt like they're not going to want me. I'm a guitarist. That happens a lot. You know, there's a lot of societies or not a lot of, there's like Chamber Music Society, there's ASCAL. A lot of those things are based, you know, in New York or have at least some sort of headquarters here. And it's really hard as a soloist or, you know, or even in a duo or whatever to sort of break in that world, because people are just like, and arts, as you know, arts admin is about sort of generating money. Mm-hmm. And sometimes classical guitar is like kind of the last thing on someone's list after, you know, getting a good collection in their local museum or something. I don't know. There's all sorts of other things that kind of come first. But you were able to kind of break in, and, you know, and this is the organization that was specifically for people of color to break into arts organizations or sort of.
Yeah. To like break in, to like really break into the executive leadership positions in
right.
arts organizations, because, as I'm sure you could have guessed, there is a lack of representation.
Oh, I wouldn't have guessed that at all. I would have thought.
especially Black and Latinx artists to be in these like really high level senior leadership positions. And so
right.
the program is designed to help you pursue that if that's what you want to do. And there were also some people who, you know, after the program, they decided that that wasn't what they necessarily wanted to do, but they still got a lot out of the program. I will say that before I was in this program, I had no idea what development was. So 2 years later, I work in development. So
that's what it's called. It's called development, because I don't know what it is.
Yeah, that's like the professional term for fundraising is called development.
Community development.
Yeah. Right. And so I had no idea what development was. And the program, though, it really just taught you, like, if you're going to be a leader in an organization, these are the things that you need to focus on, and this is how you do it. So this is how you meet donors. This is how you find donors. This is how you talk to people. This is how you talk to parents of students if you're at an educational institution. This is how you talk to foundations who are going to give you the money to support your mission. So it was all of those things and in between. So we would have like 4 or 5 retreats where we would all travel to one location and really learn from the people there. So for instance, one of our retreats was at Juilliard. And we went and we met, you know, all these people who work in New York and Juilliard, and they talked to us about what they do. And Yeah. So we learned a lot from that.
And how has it been down there? I mean, how successful have you been? I mean, you said you've been there for a year, so you're kind of just getting to know the community in Austin. But how do you feel like it's going down there for raising funds, especially you said a year and a half. Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, you came in at like the wrong time.
So yeah,
like
yeah, exactly.
Ask people for money for concerts that aren't happening.
Right. Yeah. Exactly.
How do you sort of navigate this? How, what are you doing to mitigate the fact that you're asking money for things that aren't happening or things that are happening digitally? You can't sit there and sort of say, oh, it's really important for us to get this money so that we can bring music, you know, to the concert hall. How are you sort of framing your pitch?
I think our pitch has been that we're just going to keep going.
Yeah, yeah.
We did what a lot of organizations did at last March was we pivoted, and you know, we pivoted our students, we pivoted our guitar ensembles, we pivoted our artistic productions, and it's all online. And I think that the name of our game is just we're going to keep going. And yeah. If you are able to support us, we will gladly accept it. And if you're not, we totally understand. Please still come to all of our programming because it's free. And I think we've just been able to continue to provide what we always have. Mm-hmm. And because of that, I think our community has rallied around us and continued to support us.
Yeah, I think that's what's going on up here too with John in New York, is that it just keeps on happening. I'm still getting emails, they're still getting together, they're still doing open mics, it's still happening. And it's really, it's inspirational, you know, the fact that everybody keeps going.
Yeah, I worry that a lot of guitarists will, after 2 years, have not kept going. Yeah. And, you know, not just for the societies and, you know, the kind of community organizations, but, you know, for the individual musicians themselves. I mean, I'm sure I would hope that they've been practicing and, you know, continuing to prepare for the time when they are able to go back into the concert hall. But I feel as though a lot of people have just kind of disappeared and are hoping that eventually it'll come back. And I think it's not how it works. You know, you have to keep going. And it's been such a challenge for all of us in so many ways. But, you know, continuing to make music, make art, to find ways to be together, you know, over Zoom and things like that, I think has really helped us continue to grow.
The hustler's game, as far as like getting on Instagram and begging people to watch you and promoting albums and stuff like that, that has been sort of seized upon by bigger guitarists who used to kind of like not need to deal with that sphere. And it's like you've got these huge sort of guitarists who don't have the concert revenue coming in, and they're sort of like, you know, you've got Johannes Mueller and Jason Vio and stuff like like sitting there kind of like begging people to come to their master classes and stuff like that. And it's really interesting because yeah, that does mean I came out with an album in the summer and I have no idea what to do with it. It just sort of threw it into the ether and I was like, here you go. I don't expect anything back, just here. And it is sort of like, it's really hard for us to figure out how to, you know, to your point where a lot of people are quitting. I can't imagine being a younger guitarist, even just, you know, 10 or 15 years younger and thinking like, well, I'm coming out with my debut album and what do I do with it? Like, I can't tour it. What do I do with this repertoire? Like, it just kind of like can die on the vine a little bit. You know?
I think this is where people have not taken advantage of the online thing.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Because I would say that, you know, you came out with an album, you can tour it virtually.
Yeah, you're right. You're like, stop whining. It's true.
There are a lot of guitar societies still having events. They're still having concerts. They're still meeting. There are chamber music societies. Some of them are in person. I'm not doing in-person events right now, but, you know, in-person things are happening. More and more happen every day.
Right.
So I would say that, you know, if you've been able to take advantage of like the online space and you're committed to doing it after COVID is over. then I think, you know, there's opportunity there. But yes, I'm often like, okay, I've practiced. So what do I need to do? Like, do I need to just share it on Instagram? Do I tweet about it? Do I make a video? I don't know. Yeah. All of those things, I guess.
Yeah, because you don't want to go overboard with it. You don't want to constantly be hitting people in the face with like, watch me practice. Here's how you play scales. There's a lot of those. A lot of those.
Yeah. Yeah. And playing...
I'm just like, can we all play scales, pal?
Right. I think the people who are successful right now mm-hmm. have been doing it prior.
Yeah.
Because you can tell the people, like you said, who are suddenly showing themselves, you know, yeah. playing scales or whatever, who have never done that no. before. And it's just like, oh, where did this come from?
Yeah. Oh, look. Yeah. It's just, there's a lot of cooks in the kitchen right now. And it's, there might be too many, but as far as, you know, of course, you know, you are still getting your doctorate in music. So yeah. I'd like to talk about the music part too. So, you know, what are you doing repertoire wise? You know, I know that you're getting your doctorate is like a whole thing, and you're not coming out with albums and concertizing constantly. You know, you're still figuring it out. Where are you at with that artistically and repertoire wise?
Yeah. Repertoire wise, I'm currently playing the Tedesco Concerto number 1.
Okay, good.
And I'm practicing it with the Music Minus 1 CD because I don't have a pianist
yeah.
or a space to practice. Yeah. But then I had this idea that I wanted to do a concert that was like about preludes and beginnings and endings. So I'm playing Prelude Son in Allegro by Eduardo Martín, mm-hmm. which is kind of after, Prelude, Fugue and Allegro by Bach. So I'm playing that as well. And then I'm playing one of the preludes by Dale Cavanaugh, one of her preludes. Oh. And then another prelude by Maria Luisa Nieto. So that's one concert that I'm working on. And then another concert, that's my solo program.
I've heard of Dale Cavanaugh, and I've seen her play and stuff like that. Maria Louise, what was
Anito?
Anito, and what's your relationship with Maria Louise Anito?
Oh, I think should I know
that, or is that sort of a issue?
I don't know. She was a guitar player, and yeah. she composed quite a few works for the guitar.
Yeah.
Should you know her?
No, not should I know her.
Would you?
I guess. When was she active? Is she still active? Is she alive? Is she?
No, she's no longer alive.
Yeah.
So I think she was active in like the 50s and 60s.
Okay, cool. See, it sounds like I should know her and I don't. And so that's sort of why I'm trying to draw attention to myself, is I'm like, well, this is something I don't know. Yeah.
Her music is great.
Go ahead.
Yeah, her music is great, and I think I found out about her like just Googling women mm-hmm. guitarists one day, because I spend a lot of time doing that, and so I was like, oh, I'm just gonna Google and find somebody and keep clicking, and you know, I came across her work, and I was like, oh, okay, I'm gonna play this piece, and it's like a 3-minute piece, it's not long, but you know, I just was like, oh, I like this, and it was in D, and like I feel like everything I play is in D.
Yeah. Yeah, me too. I'm a sucker for it. I mean, it's my favorite key, I'm not going to lie.
Yeah.
You too?
Oh, yes. Yeah, of course. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, like I avoid it when I'm composing. I avoid it, and then I just fall into it. And the minute I'm in it, whether it's through modulation or, you know, whatever, I'll just like sit in it for too long. And I'll be like, you got to move on, buddy. it's like a rocker in, you know, E. But as far as, you know, so that's what's going on with you repertoire-wise. And you said that that's something that you often do, is sort of just Google women composers and try to find works that you can sort of share with us, right?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's Googling or reading books.
Reading books.
Yeah.
Where do you get
I'm
those?
I'm laughing because, like, I feel like that's not the way that people think you come across repertoire.
Yeah, I don't. And explain that to me. When you come across a book, what book are you referencing?
I mean, there are many. There's a bibliography. There are lots of bibliographies of just like lists of pieces by works of like certain like groups of composers. Yeah. So there's a book, I think it's just called Women of the Guitar. And it's just like an annotated bibliography of all of these pieces. And it has not been updated in like 20-ish years.
Wow.
But the thing I love about the books is like they're still there and they still exist. And once you find it, you know that that's like a good primary source.
Right.
Whereas with a website, you still have that. But things disappear. They go offline. They're not easy to find. So one of my favorite things, you know, when I was living in Georgia, I would always go to the music library and just like pull things off the shelf or, you know, look up things, search things and go get the scores. So that's how I find a lot of things. And then just, you know, going on from there. But there's that book. There's this, there's a volume or two volumes that actually the International Dictionary of Black Composers. Mm-hmm. Which is difficult to find if you want to buy it, but it's in most libraries. But it's just, it's a dictionary of like all these black composers who it's really difficult to find some of them on the internet.
Has that been updated or is that an old book too?
No, it's an old book too.
Yeah.
So I got a used copy on Amazon. So that's been great.
No, that's important because I know that a lot of people are looking for people to play. And, you know, that sort of has been an issue for everybody trying to sort of present, you know, new works and old works that were sort of underserved at some point. And that sort of brings us to sort of a very big part of, you know, your life with the guitar right now is sort of advocacy and sort of the promotion of equality on our instrument and in our genre. You know, was that something that you studied at some point or how did you kind of get involved other than just the necessity of the fact that this is an instrument that's been dominated by a bunch of dudes that, you know, kind of look like, you know, either George Washington or me? When did this all start for you?
Yeah, so I think it kind of started at the beginning of my master's program.
Yeah.
And I think it was then because my undergraduate teacher was a woman. And so I hadn't been playing classical guitar for too long at that point, maybe 4 or 5 years. But I just kind of like thought that the guitar community was like this really open and accepting place. And not that it's not, but I thought that, you know, everyone has had a female guitar teacher and all these other things. And then I got to my master's and I love the people I was in studio with, but it was a bunch of, you know, dudes.
Yeah.
And and so I was like, this is really how it is, you know, because I would go to like music camp and I would see, and I was like, this is not maybe the way I want it to be.
Yeah.
And so I just started to do like research and I started to learn about, you know, people, and I'd always been interested in, you know, being a person who's advocating for something, hopefully the right thing. And so I just kind of fell into talking about this more and more. But it's something I've always kind of noticed a little bit. But I think, you know, after the past year, it has really come to the forefront for a lot of people, which is a good thing. I think it's a little late compared to what's been happening in other sectors in the music industry, but you know, better late than never.
Yeah. I kind of want to hear, you know, your story. And as far as like what, you know, what was the first thing that you did after recognizing that?
I think I tried to just go out and find the composers who looked like me because I wanted to feel like I was represented in the guitar community.
Yeah.
And so I remember, I think I might have asked my teacher at the time, like, do you know of any black guitar composers? Or maybe I had been Googling, but I heard about everyone's favorite, Justin Holland.
Yeah.
And I was like, okay, but who else? of course, you know, Justin Holland is really important to the guitar in America and to, you know, the guitar overall, but
yeah, but we can't just look at him and go, see, it's fine.
Right. Yeah. He's not the he's not the only black person to have ever played the guitar. Like, yeah, that's just not, it's not possible. And I'm not willing to accept that as an answer, because it's not good to be able to point to somebody and say, oh, they're the, you know, quote unquote only.
Yeah.
That's a problem.
Right.
And so I was like, okay, well, I have to define more, and I have to explore, and I have to talk to people about this. And I learned that, you know, other instruments were kind of getting there. There are, and there have been for a long time, you know, black composers writing for orchestra and for voice, and, you know, like in choir, granted, a lot of in choir, they're always like, will we sing Moses Hogan? That's our diversity thing, which is not great, but, you know, they have something that they're starting from. But in guitar, there is not that yet. So
yeah.
I just was like, okay, I'm gonna find out about these things. And then I think I just started talking about it to people and realizing that, oh, like, this was important to me. Mm-hmm. And I realized that this was something that I wanted to really, like, bake into my work as, like, a performer and somebody who does all these other things as well.
Yeah. And so what did you find, you know, when you went out there? Because I think that sort of the stereotypical opinion is, well, this is European music, you know, on a European instrument. What did you find as far as people who, other than Justin Holland, who wrote for the guitar?
I think something that I found was that, like, there's the guitar in Africa. You know, like, the banjo and, like, all of these plucked string instruments, they exist all over the world. Mm-hmm. And it's not just that they exist in, like you were saying, like, in
Europe.
Yeah,
that's true. Right.
Yeah. And so I think, like, seeing that worldview really helped me to understand that, like, oh, like, people are interested. Mm-hmm. Because there's this misconception that, you know, like, I've never heard anyone say this, but people mean this. They're like, oh, well, people of color don't want to play the guitar. And it's like, well, that's not true.
No.
And, or they're like, oh, well, they don't want to compose classical music. And it's like, well, that's not true either.
Right.
So it was really just, like, expanding my view of, like, where is the guitar and what is the guitar and, like, how does it exist in other cultures? Mm-hmm. And it's kind of weird that the classical guitar community is the way that it is, because there's guitar everywhere. And it's in so many other genres of music.
And we only focus on the repertoire of South America and Europe.
Right. That's it. Yeah. And, you know, someone might say, like, oh, I'm looking for a guitar composer who's from Asia. And everyone's first is like, Takamitsu. And it's like, there's, you know, there's
got to be more.
There's more. There has to be more. And so it is my job as a performer to tell people that there is more. And so it comes through, you know, learning the repertoire and being willing to take a chance on myself a little bit, that, like, oh, the right people will think that this is important. And if people don't, then, you know, they have the right to their wrong opinion.
Exactly. No, it is important, and it's the only way to sort of make us more relevant. And for, you know, crying out loud, we can always use more repertoire, you know, and we can always use repertoire from different cultures than the two that we've adopted, you know.
I've been thinking a lot about, like, why is it that we spend a lot of time doing Giuliani, Soar, Aguado, Etudes, and those method books. And I don't know.
Yeah.
Because, you know, I look at music by living composers, by black composers, by women composers, by trans composers. And, you know, they're still putting right hand arpeggios in their pieces, in their music, you know. So you can't to say that, oh, well, they're not writing etudes, or the pieces aren't, you know, student music, is not really, like, a good enough argument for me.
Yeah.
But I think that's the argument that a lot of people have used. And we've just kind of, like, been like, okay, well, this is how it's supposed to be done.
Right. Is that the only two people who can teach us how to play guitar are Fernando Sor and Mauro Giuliani. Wow. Yeah, there is these sort of things that are baked into the institution of learning the guitar that are inherently, dismissive of other cultures. And in particular, just sort of latch on to this narrative of, European whiteness is sort of being the central unit by which our, repertoire is generated, by which our skills are judged. And that's got to change. So I think it's something that we all have to do, right? I mean, right. Wouldn't you think
yeah.
so?
Yeah, I think it's going to
be good. It's going to be natural because, yeah. like I said, we all want different repertoire. I don't need to hear Villa-Lobos and Bach all the time. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Once in a while is fine at this point. When I first heard it, yeah, I wanted to hear everything that guy wrote. But no, I'm done. I'm ready to move on. I'm ready for new music.
I think it's going to take a reckoning for a lot of professors.
Yeah.
And educational institutions.
Wow, yeah.
Because for better or worse, they have a hand in setting a lot of the trends and the taste, so to speak, of their students. So if when I was a student, I felt like only thing I ever heard was like Villa-Lobos and,
right.
and Albanese or whatever. Like that's right. all that I played because that's what I that's partially what I thought I was supposed to be doing. And
right.
it was going to like make me measure up to all of the other guitarists who were playing that.
Right.
And I think that, yeah, those professors are going to have to say like, oh, like new music is a thing and I'm going to need to figure out how to at least coach my students on it. Cause there are a lot of, professors who won't.
That's exactly right. And I don't think it's not even necessarily out of, it's just laziness. It's just lazy people. I mean, I know what it's like to have to take something and do something kind of like that you you don't want to do. I was talking to my friend Kim, on the last episode and we were talking about, our teacher and how he was sort of like, look, this is what I know how to do. I know how to win competitions. So if you want to win competitions, you study with me. And it's like, well, yeah, but these teachers at this point, for a lot of reasons, not just the one we're discussing, they just have to understand that they're going to have to switch gears like every pretty often. You know, this is a pretty quick moving society and a pretty, things are changing and should be changing every day, every week, every month. So hopefully yeah. they get the message.
Yeah.
And how, go ahead.
I was going to say on the laziness part.
I wish more people would just make me, it's just a bunch of lazy.
I'm glad that you kind of acknowledge that though, because, I always say that it's going to take a little bit more work,
yeah.
but maybe it does mean for that myself as a professor, I have to learn the piece beside my student.
Yeah.
And a lot of, we don't want to spend the time to do that. Yeah. I fall into that too. I teach what I know.
Yeah.
Because I already know how to do it. I don't have to prepare. I don't have to think. I just show up yeah. and hopefully my student has practiced. And if they haven't practiced, then I just tell them they need to practice and I yell at them and, we go on. But there's going to have to be.
You learn how to teach from the best.
Yeah.
That's right. And that's not like, as you've had to teach kids in an hour and a half and drive there and teach rock, or whatever they need to do with jazz. So, you've had to actually sort of not, learn with the kid.
Yeah. Yeah. I had a student who, she wanted to learn like comping and jazz. And I'm a person who like, I really love listening to jazz music.
Yeah.
But I didn't get to play a lot of jazz in college because
same.
That's not what you do.
Yeah.
And so I feel like I missed out on that, but she wanted to learn it. And I was like, well, I know how to play chords and I know how to strum and I know how to hold a pick and I like playing electric guitar. So we're going to play jazz. And it was okay.
It's just like an exciting thing. It doesn't have to be this trudge, or this
yeah.
sort of like obligation. It's actually exciting because it means we have more music to play and listen to. And the concert hall, I think on a lot of levels, kind of getting more people playing the guitar and composing for it in particular is awesome. Are you working with anybody? I know that you're working. Did you work? Was this piece by Del Kavanagh written with you in mind, or is this a piece that she's had? This is you're a fan of that piece.
Yeah, I'm just a fan of that piece. I think Connie Hsu. I know she did a recording of.
She did an all female recording.
Yeah. And so it's like, oh well, this sounds great. I want to play this too. So that's how a lot of things go for me now. And I think that as a music student, we are not given enough autonomy to make choices about what we want to play.
Yeah.
So, you know, for instance, a lot of guitar teachers will say, oh, well, you can play anything as long as it's one of the 12 Villa-Lobos etudes or 5 preludes.
Yeah. Because they have those books in their shelves, too.
Right. Yeah. And that's not a choice.
Yeah.
You know, if I come to you with this piece by Tanya Leon, that's a statement that I want to make.
Yeah.
But, you know, teachers will say, oh, no, we don't know that piece. I haven't heard it. It's not good, quote unquote. So you can't do it.
Right. Well, that's the other thing is like, how baked in are the auditions where you have to come in and you play a Renaissance, a Romantic, a Baroque, and a modern piece, like every audition that I ever did.
And so many student recitals. I mean, all of my student recitals have more or less been, you know, that same, you play a piece from every era. And
yeah, because we don't want to leave anybody out. We don't leave anybody out if they're from Germany, Italy, or England. Yeah, you know, right. Those people. We have to, you know, represent those time periods. Unbelievable.
Why? Yeah. You know, why?
Why can't we make more decisions about what we play as students when we're at our most creative, when we're at our most, like, you know, our willingness to sort of like provoke thought and dialogue and stuff like that. It's such an important time to be able to pick repertoire. Right now, I have no idea what to do. I'm 44. I don't know where, you know. I have to be unlazy and find other people to play. Then right now, I just play my own music because I'm like, I don't know. So I'm just playing my own stuff. Are you doing any of that? Are you thinking about composing at some point?
Yeah, I'm thinking about composing. I think about it. I took composition.
I think about it all the time.
I think about it all the time. Yeah, I did take composition lessons in my undergrad. And it wasn't the right, like me and my composition teacher, we just didn't have the same language.
Yeah.
And so it kind of made me not want to compose because I had like a not, it wasn't a bad experience. It just wasn't the composition experience that I wanted.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, you know, I was playing guitar and I was doing the music ed thing. So I was like, eh, it's fine. But I do, yeah, I want to write more music and I've been allowing myself the space to just like doodle on the guitar, like noodle a lot more.
Right.
And that's been, I think it's like opened up all of this for me and I'm teaching, a class students now. It's only three students, and we just kind of do whatever we want. And I think allowing for them to come in and be like, "Oh, I like this music," and me saying like, "Oh, I like this too. How about we learn that?" It's like made me think like, "Oh, we can all just write music and play it and put it on paper, and that's fine."
Yeah, it's you just do it. You know, I mean, when you look at how young these composers were when they were doing it, you just got to go, I should be able to do that at this point. I've been playing this thing forever, right? And yeah, I think when you're talking about your experience in the undergrad studying with a composition professor, you know, I can imagine being turned off by that too. Because at least when I was going to Texas, there was no way I was going to go in there with, I think his name was Dan Welsh or whatever. And all he wrote was like, you know, weirdo music. And I was just like, there's no way I would feel comfortable giving him anything that I've written because he would just be like, this is derivative trash. Yeah. Did you feel that way? Was it kind of like a new music sort of like this stuff has to be completely out there vibe? And by out there, I mean very mathematical and planned out and, like, you know, meticulous.
Yeah, I think a little bit of that. And like, I play a lot of new music. Like, I really love that. And that's something that I do a lot. But yeah, it just was like, I was like, but I don't want to write this.
Yeah.
And so it was, and you know, we would have composition seminar, and it was just like, we would go and sit down and listen to, you know, whatever, like Philip Glass thing. And I was like, this isn't fun.
This isn't fun. That's my thing.
Yeah.
Is I just want to have fun. I got these skills on the guitar. We just want to have fun. Right.
Right.
But we also want to raise millions of dollars for the Austin Classical Guitar Society.
that just didn't work. And I'm hoping that once I'm not in school, because that's school is a commitment.
It's
a lot of work. I'm hoping that it does free up a little bit of that time for me to like explore other artistic and musical pursuits, because I want to learn to play the drums.
Yeah.
And I have wanted to learn how to do that for the longest time. But, you know, if I'm practicing for a recital or any number of other upcoming performances, I don't have time to play the drums for an hour.
It really is. Like, I think at some point everybody needs to just do like a sabbatical. And I think that's everybody's favorite part of like when they do their teacher training, is where they get to learn how to play all the instruments. I mean, I don't know how to play a trumpet or a flute. Anything without a reed. I don't even know how to play the reed instrument. What am I talking about? Do you know how to play anything else?
No, I don't. But yeah, it's just like, there's so much cool music.
Yeah.
And there's so many other instruments, and I want to just have fun and play those. Like, playing the drums just looks cool, you know, and it sounds cool, and I love watching people do it. And I'm like, I think I want to do that, you know, a little bit. And I want to have music as a hobby again.
Yeah.
And that won't be with the guitar because you know, you don't get a degree in guitar to have it as a hobby. Me personally.
No.
So I'm like, okay, I want to explore music in another kind of way, probably in another genre as well. I'm not looking to play the drum set in orchestra.
Yeah.
So, you know, and I mean, I have all these other like musical things that I love, and you know, I mentioned jazz, so it's like, oh well, I want to do that, and I'm gonna get there.
You're gonna become a jazz drummer. That's
I'm gonna be in Whiplash too.
Yeah, once you're done with the guitar, so you'll be like 35 years old in Whiplash, you know. Yeah. So, I've had a wonderful time speaking to you. You know, I really appreciate you coming on. I know you've been busy. I didn't even calculate the fact that, you know, everything was going on in Texas last week or the week before. When I was setting this up, I probably would have, you know, given you some time to breathe and come on later.
It's okay. No, I've been, really enjoyed our conversation and then feel like, oh, I'm cool now.
I can't believe you've been listening for that long, and it's you are part of the Cool Kids Club for sure. Now you have to tell them all to let me be part of that club too.
Go listen to Brett's album.
Yeah, be cool, man.
Yeah.
Listen to it. So I appreciate it. And I, you know, I think, you know, I'm looking forward to it. I know we're all looking forward to seeing what happens with you musically in the future too, after you, you know, get done with your doctoral work.
I'm looking forward to that too. More than anyone.
How much longer do you have until that's over?
Hopefully like within the next year.
Okay. That's it. Then you're done.
Do you
wish you didn't do it? I'm sorry, I shouldn't have asked.
No.
You wish you didn't do it. I didn't do a doctorate, and every once in a while I have dreams where like I'm getting it.
It really depends on the day. I think today I'm like, okay, I'm glad.
On a rainy day, you're like, I can do this. On sunny days, you're like, I don't want to do this at all.
Right. Yeah, exactly. That's really what it is. And in Texas, there are a lot of sunny days, you know, so it's just like, I want to go outside. I think I'm glad that I did it. I wish that I would have taken a little bit of a break.
Yeah.
I've gone straight through, and I would have said at some point to like, I don't know if it would have been between my bachelor's and master's or master's and doctorate, but it would have been nice to have had a little bit of a break.
Yeah. But you're almost done.
But right.
Get it done, yeah. And then you don't ever have to go back until right. you realize you can't make any real money, and then you go back and become a lawyer, like right. like the rest of us, except for me. I didn't do it. I wish I did. Anyway, it's been wonderful speaking to you. Thank you so much for coming on, and please, I hope that you and your family and everybody down there stay safe with all this weather and craziness.
Yes, thank you. I appreciate it.
That does it for my time with Seattle. I hope you guys enjoyed that conversation. And please take what I said seriously and go to brettwilliamsmusic.com/support. Please support the show. Please. It doesn't make any sense not to. You know? Let's do it. Let's keep it going. I've got some excitement sometimes, but I'll have excitement all the time if this starts doing a little bit better. All right? That's brettwilliamsmusic.com/support. Let's get it done together. All right? Thanks so much. See you next time.